Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter said Monday there is neither a desire for a return to a Cold War nor for a new conflict with Russia, and that economic sanctions are having an effect in countering Russian aggression in Ukraine. He spoke at a forum in Berlin where he said that while the West is not looking to be enemies with Russia, it will defend itself if necessary. Speaking to reporters earlier Monday while en route to Berlin, Carter said the new challenge posed by Russia today includes such elements as hybrid warfare, a military strategy that blends conventional warfare, irregular warfare, and cyber warfare. Carter will travel Tuesday to Estonia for meetings with the defense ministers of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, which were forcibly incorporated into the Soviet Union. European Union foreign ministers formally agreed Monday to extend economic sanctions against Russia for an additional 6 months in response to the country's role in neighboring Ukraine. The move came during a meeting of the 28-member bloc's foreign ministers in Luxembourg. The sanctions target Russia's energy, defense, and financial sectors and have been in place since July 2014. They will now run through January 31st, 2016. Taliban insurgents attacked Afghanistan's parliament Monday, wounding at least 30 people, and most of them were civilians. The assault in Kabul occurred just hours after Afghan officials confirmed the Islamist insurgency captured a second district in as many days as in a northern province. Ayaz Ghul has details from VOA's South Asia Bureau, located in Islamabad. This is VOA News.
Witnesses and police say the attack began with a Taliban suicide bomber blowing up his explosives-packed car outside the parliament gates, sending a plume of black smoke across the Afghan capital. Witnesses reported a series of explosions and gunfire from inside the compound following the raid. Kabul Police Chief Abdul Rahman Rahimi told reporters the attack was aimed at disrupting parliamentary business. He says six assailants tried to force their way into the building following the powerful car explosion, but Afghan security forces quickly surrounded and killed them, ending a siege that lasted nearly 2 hours. Ayaz Ghul for VOA News, Islamabad.
Officials in the 19-nation Eurozone are focusing on debt-ridden Greece in a series of meetings Monday as they work to prevent the country from defaulting on its loan payments at the end of the month. Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras is holding talks in Brussels with the heads of the International Monetary Fund, the European Central Bank, and the European Commission after unveiling a proposal Sunday that his office called a mutually beneficial agreement that he will give a definitive solution to the problem. Worshippers returned to a South Carolina church Sunday for the first service since a white man gunned down a Bible study group at the historic African American church in the southeastern U.S. last week. In last Wednesday's attack inside Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church, 9 people were killed. Hundreds of members and visitors listened as several visiting ministers offered words of comfort and hope to the grief-stricken congregation.
We're going to pursue justice. We're going to be vigilant, and we are going to hold our elected officials and others accountable to do the right thing.
Scores of people gathered outside Emmanuel AME, many of them leaving flowers, balloons, notes, and other tokens of sympathy on the sidewalks. Members of Emmanuel AME who were in attendance expressed their gratitude at the outpouring of kindness from the community. The suspect in the mass shooting, Dylan Roof, is jailed in Charleston. Bitter East Asian allies, Japan and South Korea, are using the 50th anniversary of formal diplomatic ties as an opportunity to improve relations that have been strained by territorial claims and Japan's 20th century era colonialism. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe attended a formal ceremony at the South Korean embassy in Tokyo commemorating the anniversary, with South Korean President Park Geun-hye planning to attend a similar ceremony at the Japanese embassy in Seoul. Earlier Monday, Mr. Abe met briefly with visiting Foreign Minister Yongbin Seo. I'm Bob Doty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wahib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
It's taking a little bit longer and it's proving quite difficult in both Guinea and Sierra Leone. But honestly, this is something we've expected.
That's Dr. Margaret Harris of the World Health Organization with the latest on the Ebola outbreak in Guinea and Sierra Leone. Details coming up.
Also, Burundi police say four people were killed in grenade attacks in the northern city of Ngozi.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Guinea, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the Greek Coast Guard says more than 1,100 migrants have been rescued from the Aegean waters in the last 3 days. Officials said they conducted 37 search and rescue operations off 7 islands, including Lesbos. Since January, more than 25,000 have landed in Lesbos, which has a population of 80,000. Since January, more than 55,000 migrants have entered Greece as the pattern of migration shifts from Sicily and Italy to the east of the Mediterranean. Many of the migrants landing on Greek shores are Syrians escaping 3 years of civil war and an invasion by Islamic State forces from Iraq. The European Union announced today it launched a naval operation targeting human traffickers and smugglers carrying migrants across the Mediterranean Sea to Europe. EU Foreign Policy Chief Federica Mogherini told reporters in Luxembourg that the mission will first involve gathering information and patrolling international waters to try to detect and monitor smuggling networks. She stressed that the goal is to disrupt the work of the smugglers who take migrants on the dangerous journey that has left 2,000 of them dead this year.
Burundi police say four people were killed and more than 24 people injured in grenade attacks last night in the northern city of Ngozi. The city is close to the home village of President Pierre Nkurunziza. Another blast at a bank in a neighboring town injured one person. The attacks in the north follow a series of recent attacks on police stations in suburbs of the capital, where police say 11 police officers have been wounded. The violence began in the suburbs of Bujumbura when Mr. Nkurunziza announced in late April he would run for a third presidential term. National elections were recently delayed under pressure from heads of neighboring governments. The presidential election is rescheduled for July 15th. A national election for members of parliament is now scheduled for June 29th. A spokesman for a Burundi human rights group says 70 people have died and hundreds have been detained by police. The ruling National Council for the Defense of Democracy, Forces for the Defense of Democracy, estimates about 40 deaths. The Burundi Red Cross says about 500 have been wounded and hospitalized. Yesterday, the UN announced the appointment of Abdoulaye Batili as special representatives to Burundi to renew talks between rival groups. UN diplomat Said Djinnit resigned the position when Burundi opposition accused him of favoring the ruling party.
President Omar al-Bashir created a political storm in South Africa last week when the nation's leadership allowed him to leave without being arrested on international genocide warrant. The fight over what happened is far from over. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir may be long gone from South Africa, but the consequences of his recent visit are snowballing. Critics, politicians, and lawyers have challenged South Africa's leadership for its decision not to arrest the longtime leader on a genocide warrant from the International Criminal Court. South African officials have argued that Mr. Bashir enjoyed diplomatic immunity as a participant in the recent African Union summit in Johannesburg. A South African court issued an interdiction to keep Mr. Bashir from leaving until his warrant could be presented in court. But South African security officials allowed him to leave from a military base without interference. Southern Africa Litigation Center international criminal justice lawyer Angela Mudukudi says South Africa could be dealing with the fallout for some time.
That's exactly the issue that the man has left, but we sit with a great issue, is that a direct court order was defied by the government. And in South Africa, there's great respect for the separation of powers, the independence of the judiciary, and the importance of adhering to the constitution. But we see in this case, all of those things have been disregarded, bringing South Africa's reputation into disrepute and also leaving us with a legal conundrum. How is this possible? How has this happened? And what will be the consequences?
The next round will likely take place in the nation's parliament, where the powerful African National Congress and the opposition, led by the Democratic Alliance, are gearing up for a debate this week. ANC has asked whether the nation should reconsider its membership in the International Criminal Court, and the DA has called for an investigation into whether state resources were used to help Mr. Bashir make his exit. African National Congress spokesman Zizi Kodwa says his party agrees with the position that Mr. Bashir was a guest of the African Union, not the South African government, and therefore was safe from arrest. He hastened to add that the charges against Mr. Bashir are grave and deserve a proper legal examination. Mr. Bashir is accused of trying to exterminate non-Arab ethnic groups in Sudan's western Darfur region. More than 200,000 people have died there since the conflict started in 2003. But Kodwa says that does not mean the ICC is a fair court.
Our view is that gradually the body has moved away from its core mandate, targeting African leaders, and it's unfair. And we think that South Africa must reconsider its position.
Mudukudi notes it could take at least a year for South Africa to pull out of the ICC. The measure would have to follow a complicated and slow path through both houses of parliament, through public feedback, through the president, and through the United Nations. Democratic Alliance spokesman Mabina Siabe says his party's issue is not whether South Africa should stay in the ICC, but whether the government followed its own laws.
We're of the view that the government aided and abetted Omar al-Bashir using state resources to escape this arrest and flee the country. Well, there may be shortcomings with the IEC, but at the moment, that's neither here nor there. The point is that we are signatories to the ICC, the Rome Statute, and it forms part of our own law. And we can't decry and lambaste laws after the fact, even though these are matters that we signed into law here. The law stands and the law should be upheld.
South Africa's parliament plans to debate the issue Tuesday. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The Ebola outbreak in West Africa is still not over. Health officials continue to report cases in Guinea and Sierra Leone. Liberia was declared Ebola-free on May 9th. Dr. Margaret Harris of the World Health Organization is following the latest developments in West Africa. From Geneva, she spoke to VOA's Jody Kapua about efforts to end the epidemic that began in December 2013.
It's taking a little bit longer and it's proving quite difficult in both Guinea and Sierra Leone. But honestly, this is something we've expected. We've been saying for a long time, we keep using this analogy, the bumpy road. We noticed when Liberia had managed to drop most of its cases down, it still took 4 months before they got to the end of their outbreak. And we're seeing the same sort of thing, probably a little bit, it's more complex and more difficult in both Sierra Leone and Guinea than it was in Liberia. But it is not something we didn't expect, but it is something we have to really intensify our efforts to tackle.
So what are the main obstacles that you're facing?
One of the problems is people in communities that are affected by Ebola still do not accept, and this is not all the people, just some people, but still do not accept that it really is the risk that we know it is. So, for instance, we're still seeing traditional herbalists treating people with illness that turns out to be Ebola. We had one such case which sparked another 20 other cases. That gentleman eventually died and he was infected by one of his patients and then he sparked a cluster of other cases. And we're also still seeing unsafe burials. So the work to really persuade people, to really help people to understand that this is something that's endangering themselves and their loved ones, still needs to go on.
Can you give me an idea of how many people are in isolation at this time?
I haven't got those figures in front of me, but there are certainly a large numbers of people who are quarantined in specific areas. So we've got a chiefdom called Cathobolom in Sierra Leone where we're seeing a lot of cases, and many homes are under quarantine at the moment there. So again, it varies according to where the infections are and who the people who are known to be contacts of the people who have been confirmed to have the disease.
Are those cases concentrated in an area where there's a common border between Sierra Leone and Guinea?
That's correct. So most of what we call the hot zone are in two areas facing each other on either side of that border. So in Sierra Leone, we have Port Loko and Cambia, which are on one side of the border. And on the other side in Guinea, we've got Furukaria and Debreca. And those areas are still seeing a lot of infections. But interestingly, when we've done genetic studies, we haven't found that much passing to and fro across the border. What we expected was that people would be moving across the border and reseeding infections. But interestingly, particularly in Guinea, a lot of the virus that we've traced has actually come from other parts of Guinea. So while these are areas that are important for people to travel to, it's not actually spreading across the border so much, but simply it is true, simply that people do move around a lot.
So the screening being done at the border can be considered a success?
We feel that the screening being done at the border is being done appropriately, and that's something that the governments in all three countries have made a great deal of effort to ensure that people who have symptoms do not travel into other areas.
Is enough being done at this stage, in your view, to stop the outbreak in the two countries? Or, for example, do you need a massive medical push of health facilities and awareness campaigns to finally stop it?
We think we certainly need to really re-intensify. One of the difficulties with an outbreak that's long as this is fatigue really sets in. And that sets in at local level, that sets in at national level, and it certainly sets in at international level. Many people I've spoken to think the outbreak's over, or they just think it's gone on too long. But the fact is, exactly as you said, we need to reinvigorate and re-energize, because this time last year was when the virus started to really burn through these communities. With Ebola, there's no such thing as just a few cases. One case of Ebola will spark a massive outbreak. That's what happened last year, and that's what we've got to stop this year.
That's Dr. Margaret Harris of the World Health Organization from Geneva. She spoke to VOA's Jody Capua.
Minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. A new study recently published by Harvest Plus shows that vitamin A-rich orange sweet potato can reduce the prevalence and duration of diarrhea among young children in Mozambique. More than 40% of African children under 5 are estimated to be at risk of vitamin A deficiency. This deficiency increases the risk of diseases such as diarrhea, which kills more than 350,000 children under 5 every year. Harvest Plus is part of the CGIAR research program on agriculture for nutrition and health. Harvest Plus and its partners developed and disseminated the vitamin A-rich orange sweet potato. Alan DeBrow is a senior research fellow at the International Food Policy Research Institute, IFPRI, and is co-author of the study. He explained how the orange sweet potato can improve the health of young children.
The way it works is the following. First, children need to be vitamin A deficient. They need to have some sort of deficiency in micronutrients that leads to a lower level of immunity. So basically, vitamin A helps build up your immune system, or it helps your immune system along. And when children don't have enough vitamin A, their immune system won't work as well as it should. By introducing vitamin A through the orange sweet potato, their levels of vitamin A in their blood get higher, and they're better able to fight off infections when they come along. And they come along very often in rural Mozambique.
Where there, it has been proven that young children there are deficient in vitamin A.
At baseline, about 70% of children were vitamin A deficient. It's a major nutritional problem, and this is among children under 5. So it's not only a major nutritional problem, but because it leads to diarrhea and dehydration, etc., there are estimates that up to 30% of deaths of under 5s in Mozambique can be at least indirectly attributed to diarrhea than vitamin A deficiency.
Is the orange sweet potato easy to grow?
It is and it isn't. It's easy to grow during the rainy season. It's not that easy to maintain. So that's a future study we're working on, how it was maintained in the villages after the project ended. But it's easy to grow during the rainy season. You basically just stick it in the ground and they grow. There's a little bit more to it than that. You should probably spread a little bit of ash to disinfect the vines, and that works as a natural pesticide. So we taught that technique, but largely they're fairly easy to grow. That said, during the dry season, the problem with orange sweet potato is it's better to maintain the vines. There are two ways that sweet potatoes are propagated. One is to maintain vines in a wet area, which tend to be these low-lying areas that are a little bit scarce and sort of near like where rivers flow during the rainy season. Or you can resprout the potatoes. So you basically leave some potatoes in the ground to resprout when the rains come again. The orange sweet potatoes don't grow as well when people resprout them. So we taught either to keep a small garden of vines near the house where you could just pour wastewater on them to maintain them during the dry season. And the dry season is 8 months, so it's long. Or we taught them to take vines down to the lowlands to maintain them during the rainy season. It's a bit hard to maintain, but when people are able to maintain them, they're a really good source of vitamin A.
And this is a natural source.
Yeah, it's totally natural. These varieties were bred locally. They were bred in Mozambique. In this case, in Uganda, they were bred in Uganda, and that's not in the study, but there was a parallel study going on in Uganda. And they're hybrids that the varieties were developed specifically to yield as well or better than the more native white sweet potatoes. And they were bred for taste as well. So we've done consumer acceptance studies to ensure that people like to eat them at least as well, if not better, than white sweet potatoes. The other thing to say about that is that not everybody likes them as much or better, but the large majority of people do.
Do the children actually like it?
Yeah, definitely.
How do they eat it? I mean, how is it prepared and given to children?
It's mostly just boiled and then given to kids.
Where does the biofortification process come into play?
So the biofortification process is, as I said, it's a conventional breeding process where Harvest Plus has taken, and the CG system has taken, planting materials from other places that are orange or high in vitamin A and basically bred them into native varieties, so crossbred native varieties, to make sure that they'll grow well locally. That's basically the process. And it was a long process. This started years and years and years ago. In other crops, I know, like the high iron beans that are coming up, took 15 years before we could get them to yield well enough to start to disseminate them.
Is this considered a genetically modified?
No biofortified crops are genetically modified.
Also, then the study was done in Mozambique, but will you be able to apply this to other countries?
Yes. We've done a similar project in Uganda. There are orange sweet potato projects going on in Kenya. Orange sweet potatoes are being disseminated in other countries. They may not have the same statistical impact on diarrhea incidence and reduction that we found in this particular study, in part because vitamin A deficiency levels aren't as high, and it makes it easier to see statistically. But that said, that doesn't mean that they don't have great potential health impacts. It just may be hard to show it statistically.
Alan DeBrow is a senior fellow researcher at the International Food Policy Research Institute, IFPRI, and co-author of the study. He spoke with me from Washington, D.C.
In Africa, as in many other countries, newly elected governments routinely make promises. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari is no different. In his inauguration speech, he promised to rule in accordance to the Constitution, to secure the country, to build the economy, and to fight corruption. Muhammad Yusuf files from Abuja.
On December 31, 1983, The democratically elected government of Nigeria was overthrown in a military coup by the country's army. According to historian and author of the book Soldiers of Fortune from Buhari to Babangida, Mark Siolan, the military government led by Muhammadu Buhari jailed several government ministers. He says the politicians were accused of corruption and embezzlement of public funds while in office, and the punishment was serious.
And what that did is it trapped the politicians and the leaders of the previous civilian government inside the country. Then the next thing he did is all of them were arrested and detained, from the president to the vice president, all the way down to senators and House of Representatives members. And they were placed on trial by military tribunals, which tried them, convicted a lot of them of corruption and corrupt enrichment, and handed down some pretty severe sentences to the politicians.
Siolan says during the trial at the time, some Nigerians had reservations and protested how those politicians were tried because they did not appear in a regular civilian court. He says the military courts had civilian judges on them, but people still felt the tribunal and the sentences were quite draconian. 3 decades later, Muhammadu Buhari has come to power as a democratically elected president. Those who remember his rule in the 80s hope he has the energy and zeal to fight corruption plaguing Nigerian society. Nigeria's previous governments have created mechanisms to fight corruption, including commissions of inquiry, stronger anti-corruption departments and prosecutions. But the Washington, D.C.-based non-profit Global Financial Integrity estimates more than $150 billion left the country illegally in the past decade. A representative of the non-profit organization Every Nigerian Do Something, Perugino Brema, says the president needs to work with people to deliver on his pledges.
Buhari doesn't have to fight these wars. What Buhari simply needs to do is work with the people. That's, to me, the greatest thing he can do, is show all these youth, everybody here, that I am with you. And let's do this task together.
Constitutional lawyer Manasara Kogo says Mr. Buhari will have to appoint competent people to win the war against corruption.
The general, the president is the one to appoint the attorney general. He's the one to constitute these bodies that are meant to fight corruption, including the Code of Conduct Bureau. The president is the one to appoint these people. So first of all, you have to think of people of impeccable integrity.
Historian Siolan disagrees, saying it's not easy to win such wars when powerful people are involved.
The type of people who we try for corruption are very wealthy and very, very powerful. So they have lots of money to buy and spend on the best lawyers, the most expensive lawyers, and just tie the government up in litigation for years. So I think what you're more likely to see is a lot of plea bargaining. What I mean by that is the government doing deals with corrupt people, whereby perhaps if they return corruptly acquired wealth, they'll get amnesty from prosecution.
Kogo knows the suspected corrupt individuals should not be allowed to buy time. Court cases should be shorter.
It should be a proceeding that should be last for a period of 3 months, 6 months, so that it is a clear case of going straight to the substance, to the tandem of the issue, rather than unnecessary bavoos technicalities that our courts are traditionally used into.
According to the Transparency International, Nigeria ranks 136 out of 176 countries, with a score of just 27 out of 100 on the 2014 Corruption Perception Index. The Global Corruption Watchdog notes 85% of Nigerians surveyed believe corruption has increased from 2011 to 2013. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Abuja.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Yiswuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Lina Mudu. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The European Union is beginning the first phase of a naval operation aimed to crack down on migrant smugglers. And Burundi police say four people were killed and more than two dozen people were injured in grenade attacks last night in the northern city of Ngozi. Coming up, we'll have music from Guinea. And in our feature segment, officials suspect up to a million illegal immigrants in Libya hoping to board smugglers' boats to reach Europe. I'm Kim Lewis with the Hayes Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. It's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Monday, Sunny.
Happy Monday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are kicking off today with Women's World Cup football.
Kim, round of 16 action is continuing at the Women's World Cup football tournament in Canada. There are two matches later Monday night. In the first game, the Grasshoppers of Norway, the 1995 world champions, go against the Three Lionesses of England, who have reached the World Cup quarterfinals three times, but have not gotten past that stage. The Norway-England game is in Ottawa, Canada, and that will be followed by a match between Las Cafeteras, or the Coffee Growers of Colombia, and the two-time world champion United States in Edmonton, Canada. The final round of 16 match will be played Tuesday in Vancouver, Canada, where the Netherlands plays reigning world champion Japan. Australia, China, France, Germany, and host Canada advanced to the quarterfinals over the weekend. The Chinese women eliminated Cameroon 1-0 in Edmonton on a goal by Wang Shan-Shan in the 12th minute. It was a heartbreaking loss for the indomitable Lionesses of Cameroon, who were making their World Cup debut. Many Cameroonian players remained on the pitch crying after the final whistle. Let's try and wipe away a few of those tears now by giving the Cameroonian ladies a Sunny Side of Sports salute for making it to the round of 16 in their maiden World Cup appearance. Cameroon was the top performing African team in Canada. Nigeria and World Cup debutant Ivory Coast did not get out of the group stage. The VOA's Nightline Africa sportsman, Shagun Dot on the spot, Adeyemi, joins us now with a look back at the performances of the three African teams.
Good evening, Africa. All the three African representatives, Cameroon, Ivory Coast, and Nigeria, have now been eliminated from the ongoing 2015 FIFA Women's World Cup in Canada. Cameroon, a debutant at the tournament, lost 1-0 to China on Saturday, to become the last of the African teams to be eliminated. Ivory Coast, also making its first appearance at the tournament, and Nigeria, the highest-ranked African team at the competition, did not even advance beyond the first round. For Nigeria, which has featured in all editions of the four-yearly Women's World Cup, this marks the fourth consecutive time that the country's national women's team, the Super Falcons, has failed to advance beyond the first round. Meanwhile, Cameroon coach Ino Ngachu has blamed the lack of funding and preparation for the poor performance of the African teams at the FIFA Women's World Cup. We need to develop women's football in Africa. We need good organization. We also need to create as many clubs as possible. If we could have sponsorship, it would be good, Ngachu says. Cameroon becomes just the second nation from Africa to make it out of the group stages at the Women's World Cup, after Nigeria in 1999. Cameroon lost to reigning champion Japan 1-0 in their group matches, but went on to beat Ecuador 6-0 and Switzerland 2-1. Turning to another FIFA tournament, the Under-20 World Cup, Serbia pulled off a historic 2-1 win in extra time to beat heavily favored Brazil in the final in Auckland, New Zealand on Saturday. The scores were locked at 1-1 at the end of regulation play, but Nemanja Maksimovic put away the winner with 2 minutes remaining in extra time. Maksimovic had earlier set up Serbia's opening goal in the 70th minute, but they had little time to celebrate the goal as Brazil struck back almost immediately with a brilliant solo effort by Andreas Pereira. The World Cup win is Serbia's first title as an independent nation. Meanwhile, Africa did not return empty-handed from the tournament. Mali beat Senegal 3-1 to clinch third place on Saturday, with midfielder Adama Traoré scoring two of Mali's goals. Incidentally, it was Senegal that opened scoring in the 64th minute. Senegal defender Moussa Ba was sent off in the final minute of the first half after bagging his second yellow card. In a related development, Traoré was awarded the Golden Ball as player of the tournament at the Under-20 World Cup. Traoré, who is based in France, joins some of football's most famous names in winning the award. Juventus star Paul Pogba won it in 2013, Lionel Messi won in 2005, and Diego Maradona in 1979. Away from the FIFA Under-20 World Cup, Ricardo Manetti quit as coach of Namibia on Thursday, just 19 days after guiding the country to its greatest football achievement. Last month, the brave warriors of Namibia defeated the Mambas of Mozambique 2-0 to win the 2015 COSAFA Cup for Southern Africa. Manetti will be replaced by former Brave Warriors goalkeeper Ronnie Canadello, who has been assistant coach for 2 years. The coach gave no reason for quitting, merely saying it is based on personal reasons. Thanks so much for listening. For the Sunny Side of Sports, this is Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
This is the voice of America. Washington, Bamboozit. D.C.
The voice of America.
Hello, everybody. From that very first broadcast during World War II, and ever since, the voice of America has been the voice of freedom. So on behalf of the American people, and the millions around the world who draw hope and strength from your work, thank you all for being the proud and steady voice of America.
Voice of America!
And thank you, President Obama, for your support of the Voice of America. I'll have more African football news, but first, U.S. Open Golf. The 115th U.S. Open finished with a bang on Sunday as American Jordan Spieth, who won the Masters in April, took home his second major trophy of the year. It was a very tight race at the top of the leaderboard, with five different players finishing within two strokes of Spieth's winning score of 5 under par, including two of the 9 South Africans who competed at Chambers Bay. Louis Oosthuizen, who hails from the western province of South Africa, scored 5 birdies on his final 6 holes to finish at 4 under, tied for second place. Brandon Grace, who is also from South Africa, was in contention for most of the final round before a double bogey on the 16th hole dropped him out of a tie for first, and he couldn't recover as he finished tied for third at 3 under. American Dustin Johnson had a chance to win on the 18th hole, but he 3-putted to fall into a tie for second with Oosthuizen. After his win, Spieth spoke about the atmosphere at Chambers Bay and the upcoming Open Championship.
I think it'll be a little crazy. This one was already, I could certainly feel some of the hype. I think you added on a whole new level on what it'll be around, especially being at the home of golf at St. Andrews and, you know, Rory being the defending champ and having the other two majors, having two people own the 4 majors and going in there looking for the third leg. It's going to be a really exciting week.
Let's hope it's as exciting as this last week was. Lots of excitement at Chambers Bay. Spieth will challenge defending champ Rory McIlroy for the Open Championship, also known as the British Open, from the 16th to the 19th of July in St. Andrews, Scotland. More African football news now. Morocco and Mauritania were among the winners over the weekend in qualifying matches for the 2016 African Nations Championship in Rwanda. Our VOA football fans will remember, unlike the Africa Cup of Nations, the competing national teams in this tournament must be composed of players playing in their domestic league. For example, a Rwandan player is only eligible to play for the Rwanda national team if he's playing for a Rwandan club. The VOA's Daybreak Africa sportsman Marco Uma joins us now with the weekend qualifying results.
Mauritania edged Sierra Leone 2-1. Morocco beat defending champions Libya 3-0 in 2016 Orange African Nations Championship qualifiers on Sunday night. Djibouti and Burundi drew 1-1. Ethiopia beat Kenya 2-0. Lesotho and Botswana drew 0-0. Namibia edged Zambia 2-1. Zimbabwe beat Comoro Islands 2-0 as Swaziland and Angola drew 2-2. Early on Saturday, South Africa outplayed Mauritius 3-0. Guinea-Bissau and Mali drew 1-1. Mozambique overpowered Seychelles 5-1. Uganda beat Tanzania 3-0. Senegal beat Gambia 3-1, while Libya pipped Tunisia 1-0 on Friday. Today, Monday, Guinea play Liberia. In volleyball, defending champions Kenya beat Algeria 25-17, 25-21, and 25-20 to retain the Africa Women's Nations Volleyball Championship title in Nairobi, Kenya on Saturday. Earlier on, Cameroon edged Senegal 25-19, 23-25, 14-25, 25-13, and 17-15 to clinch the bronze medal. Tunisia is fifth, followed by Morocco, Mauritius, and Botswana. Consequently, Kenya and Algeria will represent Africa at the World Women's Volleyball Championships. In athletics, Kenyan Mary Keitani clocked 1 hour, 6 minutes, and 38 seconds to win the women's race at the Matonik Olomouc Half Marathon in the Czech Republic on Saturday. Her winning time is a new course record and the fourth quickest time in the world this year. Little-known Kenyan Josphat Kiptis won the men's event in 1 hour and 21 seconds. Kenya.
Friends, we can all listen to the sunny side of sports.
Yes, my friend.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life.
Keep on the sunny side, sports fans, and follow the sunny side of sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is at VOA Sunny Sports. Tweet, tweet, tweet. Send me your tweets. I'm VOA Sunny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yehias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
All right. Thank you, Sunny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on The Voice of America.
Coming up, officials say up to 1 million illegal immigrants in Libya hope to board smugglers' boats to reach Italy. And next, a creative solution for wind turbines. But for some music, here is Sayon Kamara of Guinea with Umu.
I'm
Sayon Kamara of Guinea with Umu.
Well, Libyan officials suspect there could be up to 1 million illegal immigrants in the North African country, some working but most planning or hoping to board smugglers' boats for the perilous sea crossing to Italy. The officials say Libya, which is ensnared in civil conflict itself, can't cope. VOA saw for itself this week the inadequacy of detention centers in the Libyan capital. Jamie Detmer has more from Tripoli.
Collins, a 30-year-old Ghanaian, is in tears when he talks to me in a noisy and crowded detention center in the Libyan capital of Tripoli.
They give us food. I want to go back to Ghana. I love my country. I just came to raise enough money to go and start my business. I was into construction business. I was renting out scaffold and tools and equipment. But just to come here, gather some money, and to enlarge my business.
He's squatting under the scorching Libyan sun in the center's yard with about 300 other illegal immigrants caught by Libyan police or militias either trying to reach Europe aboard people smuggling boats or working illegally in this strife-torn North African country. The guards order the men and boys to bow their heads, but when they hear VOA questioning why, they shout at the detainees to look up. One guard pokes them with a stick, but throws it away when a colleague whispers in his ear. Richard, a 28-year-old Ghanaian, a plasterer, says,
"We are praying that they can do something, that they can free us. If they are not freeing us, they can take us back to our country so that we can get our freedom. Because we are here, we are suffering too much. The pain is too much."
The guards at this small detention centre on Tripoli's airport road are mainly militiamen, untrained to cope with migrants, and it shows. They're doing the best they can, but lack of training, the potential threat of violence from the desperate migrants, and utterly inadequate and insanitary conditions are all making their job harder. The centre's director, Maloud Juma Salim, says the migrants come from nearly every sub-Saharan African nation. He sees me saddened by the tale of woe coming from the migrants. None, though, accuse the guards of mistreatment. He says, "I should remember that some of these men are criminals. Last night," he says, "they tried to break out through a window to escape. These people cause many problems," he says. Libyan detention centres are bulging with such migrants whose dreams of a better life in Europe are dashed. Jamie Detmer for VOA News, Tripoli.
Wind turbines are efficient sources of cheap energy, but also a source of concern as their huge spinning blades frequently kill birds and bats. A new type of wind generator developed in Spain offers a creative solution to the problem. VOA's George Putish reports.
In 2002, Spanish inventor David Yanez saw a short film about the Tacoma Narrows Bridge in the U.S. collapsing in strong wind. It was a vivid example of the powerful vibrations wind can create when it blows past a long pole, such as a car antenna or even a stick of bamboo. That gave him the idea for a new type of wind energy generator.
The initial philosophy or spirit was to create a generator of dreams that had all the qualities one would want. It should be as cheap as possible, need as little maintenance as possible, and the setup as simple as possible.
Yanez and his friend Raul Martin took the idea to an engineering firm where they were told it would never work. Undiscouraged, they started experimenting on their own in a small wind tunnel they built. Good initial results were repeated by a larger working model called Vortex, installed in a nearby field.
What we have is a mast, which is the top piece and acts as a blade. It's constructed from the same material as a conventional generator. And what it does is it oscillates, transmitting the oscillation to a conventional alternator, which by its own oscillation converts the wind's energy into electric energy.
Yanez says the generator's output was better than expected.
We got a surprise when we saw equipment as small as this one, which is just 6 meters tall, and even smaller ones produce the results we were looking for.
The vortex generator creates about 30% less energy than a comparable bladed wind turbine, but it is lighter and cheaper to build and maintain. It is made mostly of reinforced plastic and has very few moving parts. Also, it does not create noise, and even more importantly for many environmentalists, it does not present a threat to passing birds. The current prototype works at wind speeds ranging from 1.5 to 7 meters per second. The inventors say the next step is building a 12.5 meter tall bladeless generator with a 4 kilowatt capacity that could power small businesses, individual homes, or provide supplemental power to the main grid. The commercial version of the Vortex bladeless generator should be ready for the market by 2017. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It is all well and good to have legal guarantees of human rights, including freedoms of speech, assembly, and religion. But without the legal institutions to enforce such rights in the communities where most people live, these rights rarely become reality, said U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, Tom Malinowski. In many African countries, access to justice is hampered by too few courts and legal professionals, too long a distance between communities and institutions of justice, too little knowledge about the content of the law, and by corruption that breeds distrust of the justice system. Mali, for instance, has 300 lawyers for a population of 15 million. The majority of them live in Bamako, so despite laws providing for free legal aid, if you're a poor person up country, you don't have much of a chance to get it. That's why the United States is supporting the African Center for Justice and Mobile Courts. The interconnectedness of the world means that even people in remote and impoverished areas have a greater sense of their rights. A case in point is a widow and mother of three young girls in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. After her husband's death, her in-laws threw her and her children out of their home. The mother found her way to a legal aid clinic that was able to point her toward Congolese laws supporting equal treatment of male and female children. And with the clinic's help, she and her daughters were able to return to their home. Access to justice doesn't just mean access to courts, said Assistant Secretary Malinowski. It means access to information and to government services from a government that is responsive to their needs. And the most responsive governments are those that are freely elected by citizens and that respect term limits in office. The United States wants to see systems of governance and justice that focus on citizens and that work for and empower the poorest people in society. This is the right thing to do. It's also the smart thing to do if you want to build stable, peaceful, prosperous, and just societies.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
next on Let's Talk. Join host Sunday Shomari and his guests discussing accents. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 1730 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports.
My name is Edward Ameyibo. I listen to Daybreak Africa to be abreast with developments on the continent. I encourage you to do the same.
You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.